There won't be a time to say this later, so I would like to mention to you that next week, the sermon topic at least sounds interesting. It will be dinosaurs, earthquakes, and Kansas tornadoes. And I invite you back. Let's begin with a quotation one would not expect to hear from a pulpit. I regard Christianity as the most fatal and seductive lie that ever existed. Not my words, or I'd be doing something else, but those of the philosopher Nietzsche, from whom Adolf Hitler drew so much of his depravity. Nietzsche, who taught Hitler how to hate what he called the Jewish Christ Creed with its effeminate pity ethics. I know enough about crowds and about my own heart at its worst to believe that many of us who praise Christianity for its mercy and forgiveness pay lip service to a creed we practice only when it is easy. We like to hear someone say from the pulpit how lovely the challenge of Christ is, how it beckons to idealisms mostly buried in the rubble heap of our lost innocence. But having vibrated to them for an hour on Sunday morning, we turn by mid-afternoon to common sense and ask if they are really practical luggage for our trip through the rest of the week. Turning the other cheek, loving one's enemies, believing that whoever would find true greatness must be a servant. How do things like that fit in with crack killings, rapes and robberies, the nightmare of hostages in Lebanon, all the things that make us want to hate somebody and take vengeance? My anger and outrage are as healthy as yours. And at times they are so powerful, I don't want to hear about love and forgiveness. I want to retaliate because I'm just positive retaliation would feel so good, and because Christianity is galling when it says, "Vengeance is mine. I will repay, saith the Lord." So I am in absolute disagreement with Nietzsche about how feeble and soft Christianity is. The truth of the matter is it's too tough for most of us. So demanding a way of life that we slide over the painful parts and the puzzling paradoxes and we find the pretty little moments to hold up in pulpits. We ignore the tart and troublesome stuff about pretense and hypocrisy and greed that poses as healthy ambition, and we seek out the sweet and sentimental moments in Scripture and make them the staple of our diet in sermons. Preachers even learn to speak in a special soothing voice and to smile lovingly at the audience right in the middle of quoting a man who was sometimes so angry he was not safe to be around. Not angry, I might add, on his own behalf, but angry when power took advantage of the weak, angry when justice was determined by fortunes rather than facts, angry at deceit and self-serving egotism in pulpits, offices, in schools, in living rooms. Nietzsche had it all wrong. The Jesus of history was the supreme realist about how to find the abundant life of integrity, of outgoing love, of deep inner peace that no overnight storm can disturb. The ultimate realist, and always honest in telling us that his prescriptions will be painful at first and will appear to contradict most of what we have been taught is good sense. Let's test some of the prescriptions, starting with one of the least popular. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. The translation is bad to begin with. It doesn't say in English what Jesus meant. To reflect what he actually meant, it would have to read, "Blessed are those who have their strength under control, who do not fly off the handle in frequent moments of madness." Not, "Blessed are those who have no passion, in whom no fires are banked, who are tepid and apathetic and never feel anything strongly, but blessed are those who learn as life goes on to manage their passionate feelings and turn them to good use." Now, how easy is it for you to do that? Christianity soft and weak? I think only a person who has not seriously tried to live by its requirements would ever think of saying such a thing. In the world of Christ, there were the Caesars and the Herods, men of power who bullied and shoved. If anyone inherited the earth, surely they did. But we've had the advantage of a longer look. Who changed history more? All the Caesars taken together and all the Herods, or the disciplined, controlled man who spoke the Beatitudes? One of the best definitions I know for praus, which is the Greek word inadequately translated meek, was written by Thomas Huxley, a scientist, who tells us we should sit down before fact as a little child, that we should be prepared to give up every preconceived notion, follow humbly wherever and to whatever abyss nature leads, or we will learn nothing. Now ask yourself, am I that open? That ready to abandon a prejudice? That willing to follow truth even if it leads me into some deep and frightening chasm where I cannot carry my comfortable little fictions and my petty self-love? I read the Beatitudes like this. Blessed are the open-minded, the truly teachable, whose hearts and minds are receptive to new truth. Blessed are those who find life by being willing to lose it, who seem to be filled all the more by some mysterious joy, the more they pour themselves out. in the deepest and truest sense, who else but these people inherit the earth? Vanity, pomp, pride, in the long run, they all go down the drain. One of the greatest speeches ever made was Samuel Wilberforce's plea against the abominable British slave trade, delivered in the British Parliament for 3.5 hours to an audience spellbound. The great orator Edmund Burke said of that speech later, "It equaled anything I ever heard." So it might be instructive to know how Wilberforce himself felt about his speech. And we're lucky enough to know, because on that same day he made an entry in his diary. And this is what it said. "Came to town sadly unfit for work, but by divine grace was enabled to make my plea so as to give satisfaction. Humility first, and then a sense of gratitude. Not bad traits if you hope for a healthy personality. And then better yet, a recognition that if one has gifts of a special kind, there should be a willingness to work all the harder. How ought I to labor," he said, "how ought I to labor if it pleases God to make me able to impress people with a persuasion that I am serious and to incline them to agree with me?" How old-fashioned that sounds. In our star system, the rhetoric is more likely to go like this. If it has pleased God to make me able to impress people, I'd better grab every buck I can while the grabbing is good. This is the kind of person, I can promise you, who will have a good chance of starring in the lifestyles of the rich and famous. Years ago, in France, a popular election was held to name the most distinguished of all Frenchmen. It was not a man of great ambition and power who was chosen. It was not Napoleon. It was a servant of medicine and humanity, a man of whom it was written when he was a small boy by his teacher that he was the meekest, smallest, and least promising pupil in my class. Not much hope for him to be named the greatest Frenchman, but he was. And even in his own lifetime, on his 70th birthday, a national holiday was declared, and this man, Louis Pasteur, too ill to speak, had his son read his message. And this sentence sums it up. "The future will belong not to conquerors, but to the saviors of mankind." If the credibility of Christ has been spoiled for you by some of the nonsense that goes on in churches, can you believe people like Pasteur who repeat his message? I suppose, no matter how much I regret it, that this all sounds exactly like the sort of thing you would expect to hear from a pulpit. I can only say that I would never fulfill anyone's expectations from this pulpit unless what I said was something I could believe. It is not just pulpit speakers who have echoed the wisdom of Christ. Few men have ever castigated the follies of Christianity with a sharper pen than George Bernard Shaw. But near the end of his life, he confessed, "I am ready to admit that after contemplating the world and human nature for nearly 60 years, I see no way out of the world's misery but the way that would have been found by Christ's will if he had undertaken the work of a modern practical statesman. It's extraordinary that a mind like Shaw's should come to the conclusion that even for nations, Christ was the ultimate realist. As he is on the personal level, when he speaks of attitudes that poison life, you cannot afford to let yourself hate, he told people. And modern psychology supports what he said. If psychiatrists could get out of their patients the resentments and hatreds that have accumulated over the years, they could empty thousands of sick beds. I think of a call I had years ago from a woman who sounded so desperate that for a moment I thought one of my friends had assumed another voice and was playing a trick on me. I soon found out differently. The woman wanted help urgently, and when it became clear that she would require much more extensive counseling than I could give, I gave her the names of capable colleagues. She insisted that because we had mutual friends, I would have to be the one. So I canceled a meeting and set up an appointment at the church in the evening for her and the man who was to be with her. I think after I had heard her on the phone for just a few minutes, I was not even very surprised when they did not bother to show up or even to call and save me the trip, because she had already revealed a mind so filled with hostility and hatreds that it had no time for small courtesies. As for the people who were causing her trouble, she told me later, God would get them. And all she really had wanted from me, I think, was to see if I wouldn't become an ally of God in helping to get them. Somewhere, I suppose, she goes on harboring all that bad feeling and being diminished by it. Whether her complaints about others are legitimate, I have no way of knowing, but I do know that she cannot survive with that much hostility. Christ was a realist when he insisted that we cannot live that way. Everybody knows that Charles Darwin discovered evolution, but very few people know much about the kind of man he was. He was very modest about his religious life, but in some ways he would put many of us who ardently profess Christianity to shame. His response to those who attacked him and insulted him was remarkably gentle. At one time he saw 20 years of hard work about to blow up in his face, while another man got the credit who had worked only a few months. But he was willing to risk that enormous loss rather than to act dishonorably. Half the preachers I knew as a child who damned Darwin from their pulpits would not have had the character to act as he did. The fact is that he practiced the advice about love and hatred that Christ preached, and the respect many of us give him now for doing that is simply one more proof that Christ is the ultimate realist. So what obligation do we have, you and I, to the founder of this church? I hope I make it clear to you from time to time that when we praise his radical truth in church, but never dream of trying to live by it at home or at work, we contribute to the silly notion that he was only an eccentric, a romantic dreamer. I think we owe him at least this debt, that once in a while we make decisions based on his wild logic rather than on what the world calls good sense. That once in a while we fly in the face of what many call practical and gamble on the paradoxes instead. That the modest are not muddled fools, but wise in the ways of the kingdom. That those who practice a quiet self-control will be the ones who in the best sense inherit the earth. That those who are made fun of for doing the right thing even when it is painful will be rewarded with an inner life more abundant than the rest of us can imagine. Please keep thoughts like these in mind as we join one another now at the table of communion.